Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, King.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. How could we do it? Your intellect and your vigor in getting this show ready week after week after week. And this is what, our 1,361st show? No, it just seems like that. But thank you, Audrey. You know what I mean. And ladies and gentlemen, this is Keith Haley, and I'm your host with the Blog Talk Radio show called Jumble Justice. And we have other crew members here, too, that you know, all those people, Mike and Emily, right, and Lucy, and they're all working. And Emily will come back once in a while, but not very often. But thank you very much, folks, for helping us get this show done. What we try to do here is talk about some things going on in criminal justice and related fields. Tonight would be a good example of that. And we talk about criminal justice news once in a while, like every week. And there's certainly some justice-related news. Again, the death penalty's back up again about the... what do we execute these guys with when we use lethal injection? I'll comment on that. Ohio just suspended two executions until after August 15th or something, until they do some more checking. But anyways, interesting way, you know, how do we execute people? And if you're in favor of the death penalty, you know there's one way that always works, and that's called the firing squad. Five or seven people shoot at you from not too far away, and I don't think anybody lives through that, and it can't be too painless because it's over like instantly. But you know, don't get me started on the death penalty. If you ever want to read up on the death penalty, read Death Quest, written by Dr. Robert Bohm, my colleague in writing and co-author in the Introduction to Criminal Justice book with McGraw Hill. That's now in its eighth edition. So some people are getting the Bohm-Haley propaganda on a regular basis at colleges and universities all across the United States. We dedicate this show to our energetic, tireless courts, police, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals. We don't hear much about juvenile justice. Audrey, we need to do more about that, do more about juvenile justice, juvenile delinquency, because it's almost off the page nowadays. You used to hear your radio company. I think what happens is these reporters now, not all, but some don't even get out of their office. You know, to find out what's going on in the world, I have to go to the BBC World News now. If you go to Fox or some other way, Fox and Fiends, or what's that called? No, Fox and Friends, excuse me. If you go to them, and I like some of the things they do in some of their shows, but it's just, you know, they don't go out of the office, and they get all their comments from you know, follow them on Twitter, and then 8,000 people Twitter them in about a minute, and they pick one and comment on it. Don't get me started on the social media stuff. Just incredible. But turn it off and live is my answer. We try to look inside criminal justice practice and get a real good look at what's going on there as best as we can from the news. And yes, I do talk to some people in the field on a fairly regular basis, so it's not like I just sit at my desk and do this kind of thing too. And Adam Levy, of course, is the founder of and CEO of BTR, and I need to read up on their page sometime because they got a lot more going on, but you can do it yourself. Blog Talk Radio is an incredible thing. Who would have believed 25 years ago, 20 years ago, that you could, in 3 minutes, sign up, use your cell phone, and broadcast on the radio worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners all over the world, anything. So anybody can get their show, take a look at it yourself if you want to do it. You don't have to do the show forever. Maybe you got a month of stuff you want to broadcast worldwide, and that's it. You would be able to do it. So away you go. Tonight's show, I already told you, we're going to have a very interesting discussion. We are going to listen to John Rizzo, talk about his book, Company Man, and this book was just presented on Book TV on February 8, 2014, and he's the man who represented the CIA in the Iran-Contra scandal. He talks about his book, in which he presents an inside look at the CIA's evolution from a clandestine organization to one at the center of political controversy, and it is. You know, we just had the case here where somebody in the Obama administration accidentally exposed the name of the section chief head in Afghanistan and for the CIA, and they're trying to figure out who did that and why. But, you know, I think the people in Afghanistan, you know, probably knew who this person was to start with. So anyway, if you want a real good read and a long one, it's 700 pages, but Tom Weiner's 2007 book, I have it on my desk right now, 2007 book won the Pulitzer Prize, and it is called Legacy of Ashes, and it's a history, the most complete history of the CIA that's ever been done. It's an incredible book, and like I said, he won a Pulitzer Prize for doing that. So get that book, Legacy of Ashes. It's an excellent book. One of the things he does say in that book is that in like the 50-year history of the CIA, it would come up to that point that they had never predicted anything. Anyway, we'll hear Mr. Fry talk about it, or Rizzo talk about his book tonight. I think you'll enjoy it. What you can do is listen on your Windows Media computer. You can do whatever. Green Tip tonight, I'm doing that one myself. And this one I just can't, you know, I've been watching some baseball games on television. I usually don't do that. And I cannot believe the people, they cannot stop talking on their cell phone, looking and doing text messaging. And they're at a ball game. They're like in the first, second, third rows, fourth rows, 50th row, whatever. They can't stop. And so I'm saying just one thing. If we could limit people to 100 selfies a day, think of the energy we could save here in the United States, and then the CO2 gas from people talking about their selfies. You've heard people here in the news this week, some entertainers saying that controlling her cell phone, social media, and her image is, it's so terrible. It's almost like fighting war. Is it really? Get in a Marine uniform and go see what war's really like, or Army, or Navy, Coast Guard, etc. Well, we have a Bond joke for tonight, and I'm going to take care of that joke myself. This one I kind of like. I think it's a good one. Here we go. Bond joke. Here's what the joke says. A blonde redneck, this is under the redneck blonde jokes on the internet. Did you ever see those? A blonde redneck goes into a library and says, "Hello, I'm here to see the doctor." The librarian replies, "This is a library." So the blonde redneck lowers her voice and says, "Oh, sorry," then whispers, "I'm here to see my doctor." What do you think of that one? I'm here to see my doctor.
Well,
Yeah, I found that joke myself. I didn't even have Audrey go look for it. I thought that's a hoot. I'm here to see my doctor. And we already did our green tips. We know that. But, you know, ladies and gentlemen, certainly based on the horrible shooting case in California with this young punk, let's call him that, went out and killed six people and then shot himself. Is he the sixth? I can't remember. But anyway, now we're going on and on and on about what his terrible life he led, and people treated him bad and all that stuff. And the guy is, I think he owns a wealthy family or not wealthy enough. He drives a BMW. I know that. So anyway, these mass shootings, on and on and on. We'll go on about gun control and how did he get the gun and all that business. But the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms would like you to listen to this public service announcement.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. It certainly is a deadly idea. Let's take a look at some of the news now here for tonight. And let's start off with Ohio executions. Ohio executions have now been put on hold for about 2.5 months after a federal judge allowed more time for arguments over the state's new lethal injection procedures. The order is in place until August 15th. It delays execution scheduled for July and August while attorneys prepare filings about the state's decision to boost the dosages of its lethal injection. What they're doing, they're boosting the amount of drug in both the one that your painkiller and also the one that kills you. And so now they're going to get testimony about that, and defense attorneys will approach this from everything imaginable in saying that this is unfair and all that business. And one of the guys that's delayed is Mr. Frost. And Mr. Frost delays, and that's Ron Phillips, I'm sorry. Mr. Frost delayed the execution of Ron Phillips, sentenced to die for the rape and death of Sheila Marie Evans, his girlfriend's 3-year-old daughter in Akron, Ohio, in what year? 1993, 2003, 2013, this is 2014, and he still hasn't been executed. It's the second delay for Phillips, whose execution was scheduled last fall, and it was postponed while he unsuccessfully requested to donate organs. So, of course, if you're a defense attorney, you're serving somebody on death row the day, your job is what? Delay? Or get overturned the capital punishment conviction. But anyway, it also delays the August 6th execution of William Montgomery, who shot 20-year-old Deborah Ogle and her 19-year-old roommate, Cynthia Tincher, in 1986. 1986, 96, 2006. I mean, that's quite a while back, isn't it? And anyway, we're going to have to wait and see what happens on this. But following the end of the moratorium, the next execution is scheduled for Ray Tibbetts, and he's scheduled to die for the 1997 fatal stabbing of Fred Hicks in Cincinnati. Tibbetts also was sentenced to life without parole for the stabbing death of Judy Crawford, his wife, and Hicks' live-in caretaker. Oh, my God. Well, you know, gee whiz. You probably have heard me say over the years, at one time or another, I'm against the death penalty for only one reason. And I'm conservative. I'm against it because if you asked me to do it, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't want to do it. And I don't want to ask other people to do it either. So that's a strange philosophy probably to most people, but I thought there's about 8 arguments on pro and con on each side of the death penalty issue. What else is on here about the death penalty? I had one other. Let me see if I can find that one. Can't find it. Okay. Weight. Are you tired of hearing about weight? We now have a study out. I hope our money didn't go to pay for it. It says almost a third of the world is fat, and no country has been able to curb obesity rates in the last 3 decades, according to a new global analysis. And what this professor did, Murray, of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, we probably are paying for some of that one, he and his colleagues reviewed more than 1,700 studies covering 188 countries from 1980 to 2013. In other words, he looked at research done using a variety of different methods. One used this, one used that, one, and out of that they inferred that one-third of the world is fat. Isn't that something? And income and obesity relate together. So if we can just, like a good communist nation, if we can just take income and evenly distribute it, then the fat people, the rich people won't get fat. As people get richer, their waistlines also so tend to start bulging. Last week, the World Health Organization established a high-level commission tasked with ending childhood obesity. Oh, my gosh. And, of course, we talked last week about the school lunch programs, I think, and Michelle Obama. Now, some of these school districts are sick of that. These kids are throwing this food away, you know. I really wanted some pineapple and carrots for lunch, and I can't eat fried chicken and potatoes and gravy and a roll and that type of thing. It's unbelievable. We're waiting for the celery chaw to show up in front of our houses run by the federal government. Wouldn't it be nice? No, I have to go out between 6 and 8 o'clock in the morning and eat from the trough. Hey, don't laugh. Unbelievable. In Britain, the Independent Health Watchdog issued new advice Wednesday recommending heavy people be sent to free weight loss classes to drop about 1% of their weight. Now, I got a better idea. Go to archive.org. You can buy it on amazon.com, but go to archive.org and read Keith Haley, that's me, read his book called The Three-Bowl Diet. And I'll guarantee you that you can eat ice cream, you can eat pizza, you can eat whatever you want. You fill up a bowl, a regular soup bowl, three times a day, and stop eating after that. Make your evening eat a little later. That'll help. Won't need any snacks. And probably your body will adjust to this in about a week or 10 days, and you'll say, this is normal eating, and away I go. Now, somebody else has just come up with something. I don't know the details of it. Maybe in the next week we can cover it, that says if we can have something that makes you not hungry anymore. I think that stuff's already out, but they're going crazy over this one. And so now you just put this in and you're not hungry anymore. Imagine the legal implications to that. I don't want to talk about it. Unbelievable. This is something interesting that I ran across by accident. I don't even know how I found it. But have you ever looked at the website travelbydrone.com? Travelbydrone.com. Really neat. I had a little drone and I gave it to the children of a friend of mine, but several times an hour, people post live drone shots anywhere from 5 minutes to 7 minutes, 13 minutes, whatever, of tour sites all over the United States. These are live. These aren't pictures. Where the drone flies over, for example, the Thames River, wherever it is. You can go visit Dallas, and they'll fly over Dallas or San Francisco. It's a beautiful one. And they also put in some real beautiful background music. So it's like you actually being there and flying over these places in like a helicopter. So try that out once, travel by drone. .com, and I think you'll really enjoy that if you haven't seen that. Oh, here's the other thing about the death penalty. They're confused about the IQ. Florida has an IQ test they give you. Imagine if an inmate's taking an IQ test to see whether he's eligible for the death penalty. He's probably not trying very hard, right? But anyway, it just goes on and on about that kind of crazy stuff. Let me see what else we got here. Oh, here we are. Most American kids are physically unfit. According to whom? That's the whole thing about being fat. Who says what the fat limitation is, right? I can remember seeing on a fairly regular basis some sumo wrestlers when I was stationed in Okinawa. And if they picked you up, they could throw you to the other side of the building or down the street. So I think they were pretty well fit. According to what they're doing. You ever seen heavyweight boxers or whatever? I mean, some people got a little belly, don't mean nothing. Anyway, And I think some of the super high power rate lifters are fairly heavy also. Haven't messed around with that for a while. I hadn't seen it. But anyway, just half of all boys and only a third of all girls in the study met the bare minimum threshold of being called fit. And, of course, what does fit mean? They really don't get into that in their study. But this is the Weill Cornell Medical College professor comments. And if we are unable to stop this trend, the decades to come will see us all living in a very sick country. How about that? And, of course, remember what they're doing now? The federal government, I think, is helping with it. We're now having walking school buses. If you're a little bit heavy, a teacher or some school person walks by, knocks on your door, or you stand out in front, and you start walking with them, and they start five houses down, they start at the next place, and you walk, and then I guess you got 25 people walking with you or whatever by the time you get to school. I always walk to school myself, but I never needed, I always walk to school. I was old enough to drive a car like my last year. I graduated kind of young, 17. You walk to school. You know, what's the big deal about that? And I guess we could save money with the school buses and put some people out of work. But I'm going to finish with this one. Dame Joan Bakewell. Says the former older czar says that elderly people must give up winning to be satisfied. Elderly people need to give up ambition, rivalry, and anxiety if they want to be happy in old age. Oh, just brilliant, Miss Bakewell. The broadcaster and former older people czar is at 81, said old age was a different country where the elderly felt excluded, depressed, and lonely. And she says the only way to get out of this is you give up ambition. You give up the things you just give it up. She says just give up everything. And she recommends ballroom dancing to help keep the elderly fit. There you go. I'd recommend walking or, you know, jogging or bowling or something else. But isn't that something? Yeah, I don't think she's read history real well. To find out that some of our greatest literary contributors, some of our super founding father politicians, some of our greatest inventors in science got pretty old before they actually discovered something. They lived off of their experience. And you know, there's a whole bunch of people who retired and started businesses and all kinds of things. I mean, so maybe she needs to get out a little more, and she's living too much on, you know, social media. But social media. I think that's our big enemy. Anyway, that's the news for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. And I think what we're going to do is take a listen now to this very interesting book by John Russo. And he, of course, worked for the CIA, was a lawyer for them and other capacities. And he's interviewed by Dana Priest, one of my favorite news commentators. Don't always agree with everything she says, but like her. And he's going to be talking about the CIA, and the title of his book is Company Man. So give me just a minute or so here to get this set up so you can hear it.
Up next on Book TV, Afterwards, with guest host Dana Priest, intelligence reporter for The Washington Post. This week, John Russo and his book, Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. The man who represented the CIA in the Iran-Contra scandal and participated in approving the rules for waterboarding presents an inside look at the agency's evolution from an organization in the shadows to one frequently at the center of political controversy. This program is about an hour.
John, it's good to be here with you.
Nice to see you again, Dana.
Very interesting book you've written.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start in the beginning. That's probably the easiest way to go. Can you just tell me why you decided to join the CIA?
Well, it was 1975. I had been out of law school for about 3 years. I had a good job, a good entry-level job in the Treasury Department as a lawyer, actually, in the Customs Service, which is part of Treasury at that point. And as I said, it was a good job, but, you know, I found the atmosphere, the bureaucracy of Treasury, stultifying. I mean, in retrospect, I was, you know, young, ambitious, and I was just restless. And about at the same time, the church committee hearings were being televised. And as you know, these were the first really set of congressional hearings that exposed CIA activities, misadventures, follies from the 50s and 60s. It was chaired by Senator Frank Church from Idaho. And like, it was big chunks of it were being televised. And I believe on C-SPAN, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, I was watching this, and I knew nothing about the CIA. I knew no one in CIA. In those days, CIA had no visibility at all. But it just occurred to me as I'm watching all these tales of CIA adventures that if the CIA didn't have lawyers, and I had no idea whether they did or not, but it occurs to me that they might need some now. So I just applied really with a shot in the dark.
Well, they might need some new ones because there was some wrongdoing that was under the committee.
Yeah. Actually, that's a phenomenon. Whenever I found this actually pattern repeated throughout my career, whenever CIA would get itself into some sort of pickle or flap, the cry would go out is that CIA needs more lawyers. So I was actually, I didn't know at the time, but I was hired in that first wave of
new lawyers.
So,
believe it or not, people still are confused about why the CIA is different than any other agency of the U.S. government. So just if you could summarize, why do we need a CIA and whose control is the CIA under?
Yeah. Well, of course, the CIA is a secret intelligence organization. It's been in existence since 1947. As I say, it's very present. Was shrouded in sort of mystery for its first, 25 years. So, and of course, it acquired this mystique over the years via, James Bond novels and movies and all of that. But it is, in essence, it is unique among federal departments in that, one, it operates almost totally in secret. And two, it is really an instrument of the president. And that has always been the case. The president is always the master. I mentioned in the book that presidents, and I served under seven during my time, I mean, each come to view it as sort of their personal pop star. They get directed to do things in secret. They don't have to worry about the normal congressional appropriations process. And, it's a convenient and attractive and sometimes overly seductive tool in the president's foreign policy arsenal. So it's always been, and I think it will continue to be, there have been times over the years after certain scandals, over, debacles, that the cry goes out that CIA is going to be abolished, or it'll never happen because any president, regardless of party, political persuasion, is going to want to have that CIA at his disposal.
And it can do things that other agencies are not allowed to do overseas. Like, it can break the laws of countries overseas in order to do what it needs to do.
CIA, we can't break U.S. laws, but, espionage, the spy stuff, when you get right down to it, is violative of international law. And, of course, all nations have intelligence services and, are keenly aware of that, so everybody sort of does it and it's sort of implicitly understood. So, CIA can do things that a normal federal agency couldn't do. The key thing is, of course, not to get caught or not to screw something up.
Right. So I wanted to, what I found surprising about your book was your role and how much responsibility you were given and how many times people just really depended on you to do something to make a decision that they couldn't make or they didn't want to make. I wanted to go back to the Cold War, actually, and Yuri Lysenko, and you tell a story about him. If you could put the story in context, describe a little bit, then your visit with him and what your mission was and how that went.
Yeah, okay. I'll try to truncate this. Yuri Lysenko was a defector from the Soviet Union. He was a KGB apparatchik, really. And he defected to the CIA station in Moscow in early, I believe it was February 1964, which, of course, was only, 4 months after the Kennedy assassination, 3 months. And during the Cold War, of course, CIA defectors from the KGB were considered gold. CIA has long had a defector program to try to attract them, it's a huge, sometimes vexing, but a huge important account the CIA always has been. So here it was, this guy, Lysenko, literally walked in. I mean, he wasn't.
Recruited.
Yeah. And, like a lot of defectors, he had baggage. He was a heavy drinker, possibly an embezzler of KGB funds, so he was no saint. But he came, and he not only fell into the agency's laps, among other things, had access to the KGB file of Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, at the time it was huge. And basically what he said was that the KGB never had any connection with Oswald while he was in Russia.
Which is not exactly what they were hoping to hear.
Well,
it's hard to prove a negative. They were sort of hoping to hear that there was.
Yeah. Keep in mind, Dan, this is 1964. I'm old, but I wasn't. I was in high school then, so I was on a director. I think there were some obviously different schools of thought, because some of the CIA hierarchy took him at his word. Others, most notably a legendary CIA character named James Jesus Angleton, who was head of counterintelligence at the time, was convinced that this Lysenko was a devilish ploy by the Soviet Union, that he was dispatched to the agency and to the U.S. to basically draw attention away from what Angleton was convinced was, in fact, a KGB connection to Oswald. So Angleton, who was all-powerful at the time, decided not only that Lysenko was to be disbelieved, but that he had to be broken. So Lysenko transported to the States, basically imprisoned. Secret prison, so to speak.
U.S.
Yeah, in the U.S. It wasn't in prison. And for 3 years was kept in this small room, endured endless interrogations, deprivations. And while some of his story, his backstory, turns out fell apart, he never varied about his claims about Oswald. Finally, in 1967, after 3 years of this, CIA leadership, Director Richard Helms, decided, look, enough was enough, and basically let Lysenko go. I say let him go, I mean let him go to be in the custody of CIA to resettle and try to put together the semblance of a normal life. So flash forward from 67 to 1978, which is where I found him. And I'd been in the agency less than 2 years at the time, still trying to figure out what was going on. And I was dispatched by my bosses to go see Lysenko, who of course had an entirely new name, identity, had a new wife. Defectors also not only shed their countries, but I found over the years shed their families in the old country when they come here to get remarried. Defector divorces is a whole other story. Anyway, so I was dispatched to actually go down and see him in this sleepy little southern town. I say in the book, it's something on Mayberry, where he had not a huge mansion, but a nice bungalow near the water. He liked to fish, and I was sent down on a fairly mundane mission. He was filing some papers. I think it was estate papers that with the local probate judge, and he was using, you know, his new identity. So, you know, a lot of the stuff in the papers about his biography was simply false. So I was sent down to go quietly go into the judge in chambers and, you know, at least give the judge some sense of who this guy really was and why he couldn't use his true name. So that was, you know, it was the kind of job you'd give a mm-hmm. kid lawyer at CIA when you're in.
And I said, whatever you do, don't talk to him about his detention.
Yeah, and that was my instructions. When mm-hmm. I had that reverberating in my head when I went down there. Don't talk about it because, you know, the agency was still worried that he might sue them or mm-hmm. something. Okay, I got that. So my orders were to go fly into this little southern airport, get to my motel on the edge of town, spend the night quietly going to see the judge, and maybe do a courtesy call with Nisenko briefly on the way out. Well, as soon as I got to the airport and got off the plane, a little commuter plane, there, standing in the tarmac was none other than Yuri Nisenko, who was a physically imposing guy. I mean, I described him as a booker. He had a mug like Ernest Borgnine, and he had this Russian drawl, gruff drawl. It sounded like the old actor Akim Timurov. That's what I could relate to. And he was hulking. Anyway, so he's there, which is a surprise to me. And he's not there, but he says, "Well, hotel can wait. You're going to come to my." I wish I could do voice invitations, but it was more like a command. You are coming to my house for dinner. So I said, you know, what am I going to do? So I get in this big Buick gas-heater car that he drives about a million miles an hour on these country roads, get to his house. And no sooner did I get there than he breaks out his own homemade vat of vodka. And I proceed to get as drunk as I've ever been before. Since.
I have to read this one part. You say, more than 3 decades later, I can still taste the stuff. In those days, I enjoyed an occasional vodka martini, but this was like nothing I'd ever consumed before or since. After one shot, my hands were tingling. After two, my feet were numb. After the third, I couldn't feel my face. Meanwhile, Nisenko kept belting them down and started talking even more animately. And he then really wants to talk to you about the thing you're not supposed to talk to him about, his detention.
Yeah, he starts off on this. So at this point, I've already violated my orders. First of all, at the point, he drives me to his house, starts pouring this vodka, and then starts, with no warning, starts going on about, you know, his detention, you know, none of which I was supposed to be doing. But I was, you know, I was trapped, and I was getting increasingly inebriated, and not by choice, by the way. He kept pouring them, and he kept belting them, so I figured I'm going to have to go with it. And, you know, it's fascinating, especially given what happened to me 25 years later. He started talking about what it was like
mm-hmm.
to be imprisoned incommunicado, to be subject to brutal deprivations. All of which, his bottom line was he understood it. He said, I know that CIA thinks I'm going to sue them or do something. I'm not going to sue them because I understood we're professionals in the intelligence business. This is what you do to someone like me who comes over. So he said, I'm not going to sue them. I don't have any hard feelings against anybody, including Angleton. But his kicker was, he said, but you go back and tell them that I will never forget what they did. So that was my Yuri Nisenko story.
Which introduced you to a whole spy world and sort of the characters that were so different than the other agencies that you have worked for. Let me ask you about Iran-Contra, because that was another incident. This was the scandal. It became a scandal in which, you know, Ollie North was sort of running his own shop, help with some CIA folks, and exchanging arms from Iran,
selling them
to the Contras in Central America. And you had a particularly important role all of a sudden in the hearings that were taking place on Capitol Hill, in which the legislature was trying to figure out what happened here and how did this happen?
Yeah, this was 1987, so we're now 10 years, the 10 years since my Masenko adventure. So I had acquired some experience in the interim. So yeah, I was put in charge of dealing with the Iran-Contra Committee, which, as you recall at the time, was this huge Washington scandal theater, televised hearings, gavel to gavel. And I was the guy the agency had to be sort of the focal point with the Iran-Contra Committees, to deal with them in terms of documents provided to them, to deal with them in terms of questions they had or witnesses from CIA they wanted to have testified. So I was the choke point. So that was, it basically consumed all of 1987 for me. It was an unforgettable experience.
And at one point, you're sitting in your office next to the telephone while the hearing's on, and as members want to ask a question, they need to figure out whether they're going to divulge by mistake classified information. So their aides are running behind the scene, picking up the phone, and calling you.
Yeah.
Right there as it's all being televised.
Yeah.
And you had to make very quick decisions.
Yeah. I can tell it was chapter about reality TV, because that's what it was long before that term, I think, entered the lexicon. Yeah, I had decided at the outset that rather than be down there behind the scenes at the committee, sort of, I could be more productive and more important for me to stay back at CIA, of course, and literally sit in my office, close the door, and watch the live proceedings as they transpired. And it was at that point that I would look at the television. This would happen. The hearings went on for 40 days. I could literally look at the television, see a member about to ask a question, turn to his aide in the back, slip him a piece of paper or something, and the aide would go scurrying off the screen, and I knew instinctively what was going to happen in 30 seconds. I would just put my hand on my phone because I knew the aide was going to call me and say, we're on live TV. My guy wants to be able to talk about this CIA activity, or he wants to use the real name of this CIA officer.
So you had to declassify or keep classified information just on the spur of the moment.
Yeah, just literally over the phone. And a lot of these questions I was being asked, were not only beyond my expertise, but they were way beyond my pay grade. But there was no time to talk to anyone about it. So I was literally on this high wire. And as I say, it seemed to happen constantly.
And talk for a minute about the PRT 250.
The PRT 250 sounds exotic, doesn't it? It was for its time, 1987, it was a fairly sophisticated telephone communication.
Communication.
Yeah, between CIA headquarters, the command center of CIA, and CIA stations around the world.
So it would be something we could all understand why you would want to keep it secure and probably secret in order to keep it secure.
Yeah. It was fairly secret. It wasn't, a number of people obviously used it.
Right.
So it was fairly well known inside CIA, but it never had been acknowledged as existing outside CIA, not even at the White House. As a matter of fact, this little tempest arose because the witness at the time before the committee was John Poindexter, the National Security Advisor to President Reagan until Iran-Contra broke. And it was clear he didn't know that this machine existed. So what happened, but we had told the committees about it, and we had actually given committees transcripts of relevant conversations. Now, the conversation question was actually between William Casey and John Poindexter in late 1986 as the Iran-Contra was unraveling. Casey was in one of our overseas stations, was calling. Poindexter was at the White House, so Casey's end was being recorded. And so during his testimony, Poindexter was suddenly confronted by, I believe it was Arthur Lyman, the chief Senate investigator for the committee. It was basically, Lyman basically was reading him a transcript, and Poindexter was taken aback. He said, I have no idea where that comes from. I have no idea it was being recorded. And, of course, this set off a tempest at the hearing and in the media at the time, because it was thought that William Casey, who was, had a reputation of being wily and devious, had somehow maybe constructed this Nixonian tape system that no one knew about. So, I mean, it was huge.
And you were being asked to tell the staffer if it was okay that the member could continue.
Yeah.
Asking questions, and this is what you write, because I think this kind of boils down sort of a lot of things you were asked to do at the time. You said, holding the phone, I would just take a breath, close my eyes, and make the judgment call. Heads, I would agree to the disclosure of some sensitive secret. Tails, and I risked having the agency accused of obstructing a congressional investigation in the public's right to know. For the first time in my career, I was alone on a high wire without a net.
Right. Yeah.
That seems to be a pattern.
Yeah. I mean, that was the CRT 250 flap was. I mentioned the book because to me, that was when I was really tempting fate. I mean, long story short, the committee staff alignment implored me to declassify so they could publicly explain that, no, this was what the system was for. I mean, the committee was fine with it. They didn't.
And the Republic did not fall apart once you did. I mean,
it did not. It did not. I said, go ahead. And, again, reality TV, 3 minutes later, there's Lyman reading a text. He has just run by me for approval on television. This is late in the afternoon. I'll never forget it. And the hearing, day's hearings ended shortly thereafter, and I get a phone call to go down to see the director, CIA director, who at the time was Bob Gates. He was acting director. And so I'm trudging down the hall from my office on the seventh floor thinking, you know, this is it. The system has been in place for 25 years. I had just, you know, told the world about it. And it turns out Gates was asking some other question that had nothing to do with this. And so sort of offhandedly at the end as I was leaving, he said, by the way, did anything happen at the hearings today? And I hesitated and said as quietly as possible, nothing much except that I declassified the TRT 250 system. And he shrugged. So dodged the bullet there.
That sort of secrecy and what happens when things are revealed is a theme that I've heard you talk about before. In your book, you say, you know, one thing that you learned is secrets don't stay secret very long. And so I guess that is a good segue into talking about 9/11 and things that happened after 9/11 that were all supposed to be secret, and some of them I'm sure still are, but a whole bunch of them are not. And so I wanted to talk to you about 9/11, and if you could tell me briefly, you know, you were in the building. You couldn't get away from the building. There was a crowd of people trying to flee. So what you did was you started thinking like a lawyer. What are we going to need after that? And you took your legal pad and started writing what?
Yeah. Yeah, this was this is literally the morning of 9/11, probably an hour or two right after the Pentagon had been hit, after the World Trade Towers were hit. And as you say, I was, you know, they had a building-wide evacuation. CIA headquarters in Langley is a huge parking lot. People were streaming out, some walking, some running. And I looked out my window on the seventh floor with a view of the sky, by the way, two big windows. And I said, I can't get out of here. I mean, you know, I'm going to be stuck. So I figured, the hell with it. I just closed my door and started to try to think. Basically, let my imagination sort of run wild on an unimaginable day. Anything we had been doing in the counterterrorist field up to that point, I knew was obsolete and woefully inadequate. So I started literally with the yellow pads, sketching out the kinds of things that if the president directed us to do, we could do. And that included capturing and detaining high-level terrorists, include lethal operations against terrorists, whole mass of financial activities to get at the Al-Qaeda money machine, things that we had sometimes thought about at CIA in the years before, but they're so risky and so aggressive that no person we knew would ever authorize it. But this time I knew that we were going to be asked. so I was blue-skying it.
And it turns out, you know, you were very much on the mark. The CIA was the lead agency way before the Defense Department in going into Afghanistan and trying to pick up individual high-value targets. They were called leaders of al-Qaeda. And at a certain point, they capture one of the biggest, Abu Zubaydah, who was the logistics head of al-Qaeda and helped plan 9/11. And within a couple weeks, I believe you say, maybe 2 weeks, the interrogators, mainly from FBI, don't feel like they're getting anywhere. And they're asking for permission to do a whole host of things that we come to know as enhanced interrogation techniques.
Actually, at the time, also in that interim between 9/11 and in late March when Zubaydah was captured, you know, we constructed our first what came to be known as black site, because we knew that we're going to hopefully grab some high-level Al-Qaeda guys and we really needed a place to put them. So we had constructed this secret prison overseas.
That
is one of the few remaining secrets of the interrogation program, which is located in precise locations of the black site, so I can't. The first interrogated, first of all, he shot badly when he was captured, so we flew doctors from Johns Hopkins over there to patch him up. He got patched up. But he wasn't talking. Now, it was the interrogation team at that point, I didn't actually precisely know this at the time, but it was both the CIA interrogators and FBI interrogators. I learned much later that the FBI interrogators, at least a couple of them, thought they were making progress in Zubaydah. Mm-hmm. Our guys were convinced he was holding back and was basically being pretty brazen. He knew what we wanted to hear about the next attack, but he wasn't going to tell us. So it was our people, not the FBI really, that were convinced he was stonewalling and that some new departure was needed in the interrogation regime.
And so that's when they come to you and they say, you know, this is what we have. And you say, tell me exactly what it is you want to do and don't spare me any details, because you're going to have to make the decision at that point, whether it's legal. And so they describe just quickly attention grasp, walling, facial hold, insult slap, cramped confinement, which is a big box that you can stand in, or a small box for fewer hours that you can't stand in, stress positions, wall standing meant to strain your muscles, sleep deprivation, and probably the most controversial, waterboarding. And what I found interesting here is your description of how you felt after they explained this to you, which in the book you say, you know, left you largely speechless. Some of the techniques they described sounded like something out of the Three Stooges, slapstick routine. Others sounded sadistic and terrifying, things that you'd never thought about before or were unthinkable before that, and certainly, potentially transgress the federal anti-torture statutes. And then there's a scene in which you go outside the agency, walking on the ground, smoking a cigar, trying to take this all in, knowing that you're going to be responsible for making that decision, not only whether it's legal, but then if you were to decide otherwise, that you would be the person whose shoulders this would rest. And what were you weighing at the time?
Well, you know, it's very hard. I probably didn't succeed entirely in trying to describe what it was like back then and what I felt like back then, being basically gobsmacked with all these new proposed techniques that I had no idea what waterboarding was before I was briefed by our counterterrorism people. So it was just, but, you know, this is just a few months after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Time was of the essence. You know, the thought and fear and dread around the country, and certainly here in Washington, was that it wasn't a question of if there's going to be a second attack on the homeland, it was when. So there wasn't time for deliberation. As you know, most of my career, I've never had to deal with the U.S. anti-torture statute, so I had no idea what the legal line was. But some of these techniques, waterboarding, and another one that I wasn't able to describe in the book, which is later, would never implement, but it was, I mean, if anything, more terrifying than waterboarding. I had to process all this, and I didn't have a lot of time. And I could have, you know, right then and there, this program germinated out of CIA. It didn't come from the White House or anywhere else. I mean, it was inside the building. It hadn't left the building. It was just ideas our people had. So I was chief legal officer. You know, I'd been there a long time. I knew a lot of these people. I had some credibility and influence. You know, I know I could have, right then and there, sort of stopped. I mean, stopped it before it started and say, at least some more aggressive techniques. Forget it. I mean, they're just real risky. I've been in the agency long enough at that point to know when the agency, something was going to get the agency in trouble. I knew sooner or later these things were going to get the agency in trouble. So I could have. I'm confident I could have stopped them. But then as I was walking around the building pondering all this, I thought to myself, well, here our experts are saying we have El Bouzidi in custody. If anyone knows about a second attack, it's him. And he's basically making no bones about it, that he knew what we wanted to know, and we couldn't make him tell. So I was playing out this scenario in my head. I could have stopped it right there. I could have stopped an idea that our experts, our career analysts, psychologists, operators, however measures, albeit unprecedented, but were the only way to get that information out of them. And I would have stopped them, and playing out the scenario further, there was a second massive attack on the homeland, bodies lying everywhere. And in the aftermath, I would have known, that we didn't, because of me, we didn't take the measures that our professionals thought were essential, and this is what happened as a result. And keep in mind, just parenthetically, we've been accused right after 9/11 by everybody, really, of having been too risk averse before 9/11, that we weren't aggressive enough, we were too timid. And here,
well, that's probably a good breaking point. Of course, you can go to booktv.org, booktv.org, and go to podcasts and type in John Rizzo, or the book title, Company Man, and you can get the rest of it. You heard about 33 minutes of it. There's less than half of that to go. But you don't hear much about the CIA at all, even when they're accused of doing things that ultimately we figure out that they shouldn't be doing. But anyway, that's it for this evening. We hope you enjoyed this. Next week, I think we're going to be doing a show on traffic safety, so tune in for that. And everybody's got some little tip that they have about dangerous drivers out on the road and what it causes and that type of thing, so we're going to be doing that. So we're going to ask Vera Lynn to sign us off again one more time, singing that song, We'll Meet Again.
Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.